Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Comlock Center and can be found on the web at www.comlock.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K. Tonight's guest is Dr. Melvin Morse, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-627-6008, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
And hello, Fran, and I'm looking forward in a few minutes speaking with Dr. Morse. He is a true innovator in research of the paranormal, specifically near-death experiences, if you want to put it under that broad term of the paranormal. There are a bunch of things happening this week. I saw that A former vice president got a heart transplant recently, and got me thinking about the some of the research that's been done about transplant patients, where they've picked up memories from the donor, and pretty interesting concept, you know, especially in a particular case like this with politics. You know, what if somebody that was on conservative side got a donor that was sort of on the liberal side, and how the
I actually hope that that's what happened, because the research shows, and I think there's one pretty well-known case where somebody received the heart of a young man who had died in a motorcycle accident, and it turned out that he loved McDonald's and all this other kind of stuff, and the person who got the heart would never touch this food. And suddenly started eating this food.
Yeah, a lot of cases, you know, behavioral changes, people that once, you know, had an urge for smoking now all of a sudden didn't, and vice versa. So non-smokers all of a sudden crave cigarettes and, you know, drinking and not drinking. And I guess it has to do with cell memory. And we retain those memories even in our cells, even when they're transplanted into another person. I was reading... I'm currently reading a book for a future guest that's going to be on this show, and he got on one of the subjects. It's a book all about the paranormal, and one of the chapters was on UFOs, and UFOs is something that we very rarely talk about, you know, he's talking about really unidentified, you know, flying objects that have been sighted, and it really struck me as I was reading through it is that in most of these cases, like he was talking about a case that happened, I believe, in 2008 in a small town in Texas, where virtually a large percentage of the town saw these formational lights at once. They, you know, a massive craft that was soundless and could travel faster than any speed that we knew. And the witnesses were a lot of, you know, there were police officers, you know, there were mayors. I mean, they were reputable people, and people were very afraid to, you know, to talk about it. And this was all, and we've seen other cases about the Phoenix Lights, and, you know, where you have literally thousands of
people. And that's been going on for years now.
Yeah. Now, but what struck me is that this is information that people receive based upon their physical senses, right? Now, people are always arguing when we talk about the psi-related phenomena, you know, and so-called paranormal phenomena, that we don't perceive these things with our five senses, so they don't believe it. You know, in the UFOs, it's, you know, it's kind of the opposite. People do perceive it, that, you know, they have visual contact or audio contact, and yet the evidence is discounted just the same. So, you know, the...
Yeah, but the motivation for discounting it is different. I mean, this is the government probably stepping in and saying one of two things. Either we don't want to alarm everybody, which would be probably a good thing for them to be doing, or we know a whole lot about this and we don't want to share it with you right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think when it comes to the subject of UFOs, it's very likely... It's similar to a lot of things that we study. Most of the things are a great percentage of them are not what they appear, you know, where they could be fraudulent, they could be set up, they could be explained by normal causes, physical phenomena, but yet there are some that can't be explained. And I'm certainly open to the idea. I think it makes a lot of sense to me that there are inhabitants of other you know, planets throughout the vastness of the universe. It doesn't make sense that there wouldn't be. You know, why wouldn't there be? So, I mean, what are your feelings on it?
I've never. I mean, I remember the UFOs from when we were kids, and that was when it became really popular in the '60s, or that they were starting to first visit us in the '60s, maybe. And I remember believing in it then. But I also remember all the propaganda that was out there. Oh, it's just a weather balloon, or it's just a plane that's flying too slow, all the excuses.
Right. And a lot of people make the argument, okay, so let's say that there is, and there are people with, you know, this technology. I mean, how would they find our little speck of a planet, you know, in the vastness of the universe, and why would they come here?
If they have the technology to make an aircraft that's silent,
right,
then they know where everybody is.
That's a good point. And they may be, if it is true, I mean, people could be visiting multitudes of planets, could be millions, you know, of inhabited planets. You know.
And galaxies and universes.
I still think we remain very Earth-centric, you know, thinking that we're, that everything revolves around Earth, and that's the only place where life was created. No matter what your views are, whether you believe in creationism or randomness or the Big Bang, it certainly makes sense in any scenario where there would be life on other planets.
But the fact that governments are constantly exploring other planets in space means they too believe that there is life elsewhere.
Yeah, and you know, and similar to, look, we know that the government did secret studies. We talked about it very often with remote viewing and the Stargate Project, and it was top secret for, you know, many, many years. And I would assume that if there is such a thing and we are being visited, that the government is very much aware of that and they're keeping that, you know, silent too. You know, when they declassified the remote viewing projects, they still poo-pooed it, as you like to say, you know, that they still were
because,
reluctant
because to... Because the government really
it didn't
thinks,
work. Right?
The government really thinks we're all stupid.
Right. Well, we're going to go to our first break, and when we come back, we're going to welcome Dr. Melvin Morse. So stay with us, and we will be back in a couple of minutes.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight hopefully is Dr. Melvin Morse. We're waiting to still get him on the line. Our sponsor is the Comlock Center and can be found on the web at www.comlock.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K.com.
And as Fran mentioned, Dr. Morse is evidently delayed, so we anxiously await his arrival. You know, what I always found different about Dr. Morse is that we have talked with quite a number of researchers and physicians, you know, who study the near-death experience. But Dr. Morse has a different perspective because as a pediatrician, work with a lot of very critically ill children, he actually resuscitated the same patients that he would later study. And that I find interesting, because wouldn't you think, Fran, that if you resuscitated somebody, that you have a maybe feel a special bond with them?
That never occurred to me, but clearly you would.
Yeah, I mean, you're bringing the person, you know, back to life.
Particularly a child.
Yeah, and then they're talking about, you know, experiences. And we've always said that, you know, the experiences with children we find to be more evidential than those with adults, because they're, you know, they haven't been filtered, their views have not been colored, and they just say what they experience without fear of repercussions or being judged. So, I know that Dr. Morse has written several books, Closer to the Light, Transformed by the Light, and probably his best book, you know, he calls Where God Lives, The Science of the Paranormal and How Our Brains Are Linked to the Universe. Now, we have interviewed people, you know, over the years that had different theories involving the brain and how the brain can facilitate communication, you know, with the other side. You know, one that comes to mind is Dr. Rick Strassman. We've interviewed him. He wrote a book about the DMT molecule, and his theory is that DMT, which is a naturally occurring hallucinogen, that occurs not only in our bodies but in plant life and other species, is actually released by the pineal gland that we all have. And this hallucinogenic substance enables us to actually, you know, make a connection to these other realms. Dr. Morse believes that we have an area in our brain that, you know, facilitates a connection to these other realms of information. He says it's in the right temporal lobe. And virtually all these things that we talk about, I mean, not only communicating with spirit, but connecting with this vast these vast dimensions of information is actually facilitated by our brains. Now, of course, what happens when we don't have our brains anymore and we physically die? Well, then we're just pure consciousness or pure light or pure information, and we don't need to have a physical organ. We're part of it, you know. So, I mean, that all makes very sense. I hope one day that people will be able to actually prove it, you know, in a scientific study, and I think it's going to happen eventually. Now, what was also fascinating in reading the book is that, similar to adults, a lot of the children experiences, when they come back, they return with intuitive abilities. They didn't know what intuitive abilities were. They probably don't even know when they have them when they come back. But nonetheless, it stays with them, and they develop psychic abilities. So you ever think of what might happen? You think the very fact that they were over there, is they get in, sort of assimilate all these. On the other side, everybody has these abilities because you're an entity of thought. So just by very fact of being to the other side, you think you bring some of that back?
Not necessarily. I think it's a product of being on the other side. And I think that and I know this is a debatable topic, but when you agree to incarnate and you supposedly choose the vehicle for your soul that you're going to, the life that you're going to live,
right,
it probably at that point is determined whether or not it's going to include our innate ability to remain in contact with the other side.
Yeah, well, the other thing that you worry about, a lot of people say that, you know, these children come back, you know, because, you know, there were still lessons to be learned. Actually, it's not only a children, you know, adult near-death experiences, you know, describe the same thing. Sometimes I have a hard time with that concept, you know, of lessons, you know. I mean, what do you think is the determination of why some people come back and some don't? I mean, you know, most, we only hear from the people that come back.
You mean after a near-death experience?
Yeah.
Because they're sent. Two things happen that I continue to read from reports of people returned. Either they are told by some entity that they need to go back, that it's either not their time or they just have to go back, or they're given a choice on whether or not they want to go back, which would imply that whatever reason they incarnated for, they had already completed that part of the bargain.
So you think that some of the people, they're given the choice and they say, no, I'll stay. And then, but yet...
I'm not going to hear about that.
Right. And others will say...
I have children, I have a family, I need to go back.
Well, so some say, I'll stay in the afterlife, and then they're told that they can't. And some say, okay, I'll stay in the afterlife, and they say, okay.
But I don't think it's always posed as a question.
Yeah.
I think it's very clear once you're on the other side, whether by accident, old age, or whatever it is, that you're on the other side, that there is some telepathic communication that says to you either you have the option to stay or you must go back.
Right. And the reason why you must go back is always the same, that you have more to do or you have lessons to learn?
And I don't know, because that part is never communicated, the reason why they've chosen, the person has chosen to come back in those cases where they were given the choice.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, so now you're told that, you're in your near-death experience, that you need to come back because there's more that you have to do and there's lessons to learn. So now you come back and you may say to yourself, okay, now what are these? Obviously I'm supposed to be doing something important. Don't you think it might be troublesome for these people to figure out what exactly it is that they're supposed to be doing? I know a lot of people, the experiences come back and they make major life changes. They certainly feel more compassion. They feel more love. They're less materialistic. And these are all, tremendous, qualities, and they change their lives because of it. So I think that it's really interesting. But I always think about, it could also be very troublesome. I know I'm supposed to do something, but I can't figure out what it is. And also, I would figure, how long does this, people say that it stays with them for the rest of their lives, but yet children, the evidence would show that they forget their experiences as they get older.
Or maybe they learn to block it out because it's not acceptable.
Do we have Dr. Morris?
We have Dr. Morris.
Dr. Morris, are you with us?
I have comments on both of those. I have comments on both of those points.
Then we would love to hear that.
Okay.
Well, go right ahead.
Can I just jump in right now?
Yeah, while you're here, let me just give you a quick intro. Dr. Melvin Morris is a pediatrician. His work has led him to conduct comprehensive research into the near-death experiences of children. Dr. Morris is also the director of the Institute for the Scientific Study of Consciousness, which focuses on many areas of exploration. His work has been well publicized over the years. He's been the subject of dozens of documentaries. He's been on Oprah. He's been on 2020, 60 Minutes, Good Morning America, Larry King, you name it. He's been on it. His groundbreaking work has led him to believe that we all have an area in our brain that facilitates a connection to other realms of information and existence. His well-known books include Closer to the Light, Transformed by the Light, and Where God Lives. And the website, which I encourage you to visit, is spiritualscientific.com. Now I officially welcome you. Could you answer that question you were going to answer?
Well, I just have to tell you a hilarious story. I did a study of adults who had near-death experiences as children, and then I also followed the children that I had resuscitated and, heard their near-death experiences. I followed them out about 15 years and then, and also studied them over the years. And so, this always comes up that they feel that, persons who've had near-death experiences, they feel that they've come back for a reason. And so this young man, he was in his mid-20s, and he told me that he had a very, very special job to do. This is when I was earlier in my career, so, I was just a little bit more, just a little bit more cynical, I guess, back then.
Yeah.
And I was thinking to myself, what's he going to tell me? That, he's going to invent a cure for cancer, or he's going to, start a new religion, it's going to be something like that. So I said to him, okay, well, all right, so tell me, what is this special job that you're going to do? And he looks at me and he goes, I already told you when I filled out the questionnaire for your study, I told you that I run a small construction company. Said that's where he said I have 4 employees, and those numbnuts wouldn't know what to do if it weren't for me that I can get them the jobs. And he was indignant that I had forgotten what his job was.
Right.
Well, I think that sums it up.
Yeah, I guess
they,
so.
They come back to, to live their ordinary lives. And, he came back to run a small construction company.
That was
the meaning of his near-death experience.
Right. Well, we were talking a little bit before you came on, and I mentioned the fact that you have a totally different perspective, because you're one of the few people that researches near-death experiences, and you've actually resuscitated, you know, your own patients, and then later, you know, studied them. And one thing that came up is, do you ever feel, or do you continue to feel a special bond with these children? I mean, after all, I mean, you held their lives in your hands, you brought them back to life, and then they describe these otherworldly experiences. I mean, do you feel connected to them?
Oh, absolutely. I just spoke with the first patient that I resuscitated who told me her near-death experience just a couple of months ago. And it was almost a religious experience for me. I mean, it was so intense. I was just choked up with emotion to hear what she had done with her life, and you know, that she was married and had children, and you know, just, I mean, I felt overwhelmed by it. Mm. And you know, I have felt that kind of a bond with all of them. And as they've grown into adulthood, really, when I talk to them, it's like talking to an old friend.
Yeah.
I wanted to comment on another point you all made, was a transformation of the near-death experience. It does not seem to depend on them remembering the experience. And when you think about it, that makes sense, because, you know, we all know people that have gone through life-threatening events, and then, you know, they swear they're going to change their life or whatever. You know, people have, you know, get leukemia, and eventually they're cured. And so this causes them to look back at their life again. But actually, those types of events are not really, you know, transformative. Oftentimes after, you know, you have a, you know, you're in a car accident and yet you survive, you see life a little bit differently for a while, but then you go back to, you know, your same old habits and patterns. And
right.
That does not seem to be the case with a near-death experience. When we studied adults who had near-death experiences as children, we found the same transformation whether they remembered their experience or not.
Ah.
And, you know, and the transformation is quite profound. We did a very nice study. We had five separate control groups to try to, look at all the different aspects and control for them.
Right.
And you know, we found that adults who had near-death experiences as children, they gave more money to charities than our control populations. They use fewer over-the-counter medications. They're more likely to be in the helping professions. It's interesting. They spent more time alone, whether it be a walk or meditation or something like that, and yet they also spent more time with their families than our control populations.
Hmm.
And this really, I would say probably a third of the adults who had near-death experiences as children really didn't remember their experience.
And so how do you explain, you know, the long-lasting, you know, life-changing events if they have no memory of it?
Well, I call it that they had a near, you know, a post-traumatic bliss syndrome.
Right.
You know, I don't think there's, you know, I don't want to beat around the bush about it. I think they're touched by God. I mean, I don't really, you know, that's not a word that comes easily to me, because I don't, you know, all the caveats. I don't know what God is. I don't want to get into that whole, you know, debate where people say to me, well, you know, I don't believe in a God. I believe in a higher power. You know,
right.
That's why, by the way, that's why I like studying near-death experiences in children, because, you know, they just go, God smiled at me.
Right.
You know, they don't have all the, you know, but I mean, I think that, you know, they have been touched, and that it's that, you know, their souls have been transformed
right.
by interacting. I don't think there's any getting around it. We have, I mean, it's extraordinary to me. But now, see, one advantage I had in my study was it was done back in the 1990s. So we had a number of patients, you take an adult in their 60s and 70s. So they may have had their near-death experience as a child. It would have been back in the 1930s and 40s. And back in the 1930s and 40s, I mean, you know, people had cardiac arrests, and they were never told about it. Their parents were never told about it. You know, that was back in the day when, you know, you just sort of, you know, buffed the charts and, you know, just were glad that the patient survived. And, you know, it's not all the informed consent. And so we had quite a few patients who were not aware that they had near-death experiences and yet displayed the typical aspects of the transformation.
When you reflect back, and when you first really got into this and started studying and interviewing people that came back, as you started to see the similarities in the accounts, I mean, did you think that something, did it cross your mind that something spiritual was taking place, or were you looking at it from a medical perspective and trying to come up with an explanation that would explain such things?
Quite honestly, I'm still struggling with the spiritual aspects of it.
Yeah.
I've had a hard time with that part of it. I just, you know, for many different reasons. One is, I think the major one is I've always felt that it's crossing a line, you know, as a scientist to start to comment. Even now, I'll just tell you, I'm already having second thoughts that I said that the transformation was because they were touched by the divine. As soon as I said that, I said, wait a minute, I can't say that. I mean,
well, you said it.
That's so overwhelmingly common sense that, you know, that you can say it.
Yeah.
But I've never really, I don't know. It's very, very difficult. It wasn't until I started to have, you know, my own sort of, you know, spiritual experiences that I've really been able to come to grips with it.
Now, I've
just compartmentalized that. I've never really believed in a God, and I've never, you know, I don't understand what God is, and, you know, I guess I would just prefer to say this is something that they seem to believe in, that they seem to, is important to them.
When I know that I enjoyed, you know, the book that you wrote some time ago now, you know, Where God Lives, and you didn't have trouble in the putting it in a title then, and it was an apt title. But in a lot of your current research and in the articles and in this book, I mean, you talk about an area in our brain, the right temporal lobe that you refer to as the God spot. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
Where is it located?
I don't think there's no getting around it. I proposed back in 2002 that we have an area of our brain which actually links us to the universe. You know, that I mean, if we are to take seriously what the theoretical physicists tell us, which is that this is a timeless, spaceless reality at its, you know, core, then we have to accept that the entire universe can exist within our brain. And I don't think there's any question about it. The only criticism that I've gotten from my fellow neuroscientists in the last, 10 years is Mario Beauregard wrote a book in which he said that it's not a God spot, it's a God brain. You know, that perhaps 30 to 40% of our brain is devoted to permitting us to have this experience.
So
I think that I know that this is a challenging concept for people, and I had a hard time, quite frankly, understanding why. Because to me, I mean, we have a huge area of our brain which permits us to create the visual image, and yet nobody thinks that, you know, the visual images that our brain creates, our hallucinations are just in the brain. So I would think that knowing that we have anywhere from 10 to 30% of our brain dedicated to having spiritual experiences, I would think that would mean, you know, that it's more likely that these are, in fact, you know, well, for lack of a better word, that these are real experiences. Well, I love the way children talk. It was real, Dr. Morse. It was realer than real.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah. I mean, to me, having a God spot, to me, is one piece of circumstantial evidence that the God that we're perceiving, or, you know, as part of this experience, is real, you know, just as real as this conversation.
Well, whether we call it a God spot or a telepathic center or whatever we call it, it certainly makes sense that we would have some part of our anatomy that would facilitate, you know, otherwise how do we communicate at all? Some believe it's on a cellular level. Some believe it could be connected to your heart. You know, I know, what do you think of Rick Strassman's theory about DMT and being released by the pineal gland, and that facilitates, helps to facilitate such communication? I mean, I don't know whether,
oh,
I don't know much about brain now.
I think that what you're saying is very, I mean, it's not just, I think that it, here, oh, let me start again. I'm getting too excited. Here is a very interesting phenomena. Almost anyone who starts in this field to look at the biochemistry of the experience, like you're saying with Rick Strasberg or Jensen before him, or myself, who really spent a lot of time, with the neuroanatomy of the experience, etc., all seem to come to the same conclusion, which is that it is a real experience. It's a real experience mediated by brain chemistry. And think about it. All human experience has to be mediated by our brain biochemistry and by our brain. I mean, that's why we have a brain,
right,
to exist in this reality so that we can learn our lessons of love. I mean, if we're to, first of all, I think that that's clearly a scientific fact. I think in the year 2012, it's a scientific fact, not a philosophical truth, that we are here to learn lessons of love. That's what you learn from those who have died and have the experience of dying, have come back to share with us. So if we're here to learn our lessons of love, well, then obviously we must have some sort of arena in which to learn those lessons. That's why we have a brain. And I think it's very reassuring. Let's face it, many people have suffered enormously in this life. I think that, much of my work is because I started in critical care medicine, and so many of my patients died. I mean, it's just, and then the grieving of those parents. And yet it's clear that when we die, we get some sort of, gigantic hug from whatever this God is. I mean, we're embraced by unconditional love. It appears to me that we die in a sea of love, and that we're accompanied during that process by something that helps to mediate the experience for us. Whether, if it's a 2-year-old child, it might be their favorite lammy. If it's a 7-year-old child, it might be, a dog that they love that had died before them. And I'm certain if my wife dies before me, it'll be my wife will mediate that experience.
Yeah.
And so I don't find it hard. So when I read books like I'm just reading a book now on the spiritual brain, and it's bizarre for me to read because the author is arguing the opposite. He says that because we have all this these structures within the brain that mediate the spiritual experience, then they must just be in the brain. And quite frankly, I don't understand that line of thinking. And yet it does seem to be a very powerful one.
Yeah. Well, I guess, when they do these studies where they stimulate an area of the brain and they could replicate a few of the common experiences that are seen in the NDE, then people say, oh, see, it is something that's manufactured, you know, in the brain because we can stimulate it. But that, as you said, it doesn't really hold water. I mean, if there is an area in the brain, we should be finding ways to stimulate it so we all can have these experiences, don't you think?
Well, you're a very daring guy because you're sort of, I mean, let's face it, you're now, you know, intruding on, I think, sort of a taboo topic in the world of near-death experiences. Which, quite frankly, would be then, you know, could you take, you know, like you, well, you're saying earlier, you know, DMT or ayahuasca,
yeah,
or, you know, LSD, etc., and perceive a real God. And that, you know, that question was actually taken seriously in the 1950s and early 1960s. And then it fell out of favor because, you know, of the abuse of LSD. And, you know, the obvious reality that people that took LSD over and over again were not some sort of spiritual beings, but usually fried their brains.
Yeah.
So, and then I think there's sort of a fear that if we say that line of thinking is could be true, that then people will then, you know, say, oh, well, Dr. Moore said to just go take LSD and you can perceive God. And, you know, so, but quite frankly, I think that reflects the simplicity of the debate. You know, that unfortunately, I think our society is looking at these issues in a very, very superficial way. I'm looking right now, I've been reading a book called The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain, and it's by Kevin Nelson. And he is very commonly portrayed in the media, etc., you know, as proving that near-death experiences aren't real. You know, that he has proven that they're just in the brain. And yet, when I read the book, I find it quite inspirational.
Yeah.
it's far more complex than the debate I was quite surprised to read the book. I thought it would just be some, you know, sort of like Matthew Albert's The God Area of the Brain, which, you know, quite frankly, is a very simplistic book. But this is a very complex book in which he brings up a lot of these kinds of challenging issues. And I don't think that he's concludes at the end of the day whether God is, you know, this is a real God or not.
Right.
In fact, and I don't think that should be what we learn from near-death research. Because if we're here to learn lessons of love, then it is up to each one of us, you know, at the end of the day, to make our own statement of faith and to understand and interpret this information the way, you know, the way it means to us.
Yeah.
And if that means that some people are going to, you know, take psychoactive drugs and think that they can, recreate the near-death experience, etc., you know, I think that's one way to learn a lesson of love. They may be, I don't think it's for me to judge that.
Right.
But I'm surprised on your radio show you bring that up because, I haven't heard that issue discussed probably in 15 years.
I wasn't necessarily going the psychoactive route. I was talking about could be a stimulation through electronic shock or some sort of other laser-like kind of invention. But
yeah.
But certainly.
Well, then I agree. I mean, I know that I deliberately, just because you had charged me before we appeared on the show, that your listeners are ready to take on the more complex aspects.
Yeah, our listeners certainly are.
I will admit that I did sort of force that. But nevertheless, now to go back to your specific issue, you have the work of Michael Persinger, who has these magnetoencephaly. They were used, to read the magnetic and electromagnetic pictures of the brain, but they can also be used to stimulate areas of the brain. In fact, when I was in Sweden last May, they had presented a lot of this research where they actually stimulate. They put on these very complex helmets, and then they'll stimulate areas in the brain in this God spot area of the brain. And sure enough, people do report near-death experiences. You know, you started the show off by saying that, you know, that I'm sort of blessed because I have heard these experiences personally from children that I personally resuscitated. And, I mean, that has been actually one of my main motivations in continuing this research, because I take that obligation seriously. You know, so many of the researchers have to look through medical charts, or they have to try to figure out, you know, in retrospect, whether the patient was dead or not. Certainly much of the skeptical stuff I hear, I well understand, because, you know, but if they were at the, you know, position I was, where you hear these children and you hear the wonder in their voice, and, you know, and they're trying to understand a complex experience. So one little girl, we put a needle in her heart to resuscitate it, you know, to resuscitate her. And she comes back, and she says to us afterwards, she says, well, I went somewhere, and then I was back. And so we, of course, you know, I said, well, what do you mean you were back? And she clenched her fists, and she says, that's what I've been trying to figure out. So,
Dr. Morse,
so you can contrast that with Michael Persinger's research and others, you know, who have stimulated that area of the brain. And I can tell you that they are nothing alike. You know, I really think that it's the neurophysiological sort of dry run of the experience. You know, it's probably like a, you know, a simulation of the experience. Because I've heard his college students talk about it, and I had the opportunity of, you know, interviewing someone who had actually been in his studies. And they really just sort of say very, almost mechanically, you know, and then I saw a light, and it did seem to be a light like I'd never seen before, etc. But you don't hear that incredible wonder in their voice. And so,
right. You
know, I think this can, I think that, you know, this isn't real, you know, this is more subjective, but I think that this, you know, adds another element to this whole debate of, you know, what is the God spot? Mm. I think, you know, it's, I think it's the TV set, it's the tuner, you know, that, but you have to actually connect with a real God to have the actual experience.
Right.
At least that is my overwhelming impression, you know, having heard personally dozens and dozens of near-death experiences from children that I've actually resuscitated. Right.
We have a bunch of people that would like to speak with you. Could you mind taking a call?
Oh, I'd love to. Sure.
Okay.
Okay, we have Donna on from New Jersey on line 3 with a question. Donna, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate the opportunity. Interesting, on the right temporal lobe, my husband passed away 2 years ago from glioblastoma brain cancer, which was found in his right temporal lobe. 2 years after that, to the day that he died, my eldest sister was just diagnosed with the same thing. And in speaking with both of them and their symptoms, they had none other than deja vu, and the sense of everything being much more real than real and more dimensional than four dimensions.
Hmm.
That was their both of their initial attacks, which they later called seizures.
Right.
But both of them said it was very mystical and very what you hear mediums say that the afterlife is like more vivid, more depth, more dimensional. And I don't know what to make of that, but...
Well, what do you make of that, Dr. Morse?
Boy, what I, first of all, Donna, I would love it if you could contact me through my website, because I would love to hear your story in more detail. I think that's absolutely riveting and very, mm-hmm. I think that's very important information. So, you know, so let me back up a moment, though, because this really ties into your earlier question, is how do we know what, you know, what the brain is for and how it works? So back 100 years ago, they looked at, you know, people if they had tumors in the area of the brain that is, you know, controls speech, for example, then the, you know, people would lose their ability to talk or to comprehend the written word. And so we would say, aha, that area of the brain obviously controls our ability to write and to speak. And so the brain was, you know, initially mapped out that way. Then you had the work of Wilder Penfield, who actually directly stimulated areas of the brain. So he stimulated the motor cortex, and people would move their arm. And then he stimulated this right temporal lobe, and people would say things like, oh, God, I'm out of my body. Or even more interesting, they would say, I'm half in and I'm half out. So no one doubts that when he stimulates the motor cortex and they move their arm, that you know, means that that's the part of the body that allows us and permits us to have control over, you know, our arm, our leg, etc. And yet, for some reason, when we come to that same area of the brain that allows us to see God, then, you know, all this controversy springs up. And what Donna just shared with us is very interesting, because she's really saying that, you know, confirming in my mind that there is an area of our brain which permits us to enter into non-local consciousness. And, you know, non-local simply means the timeless, spaceless, universe of the, you know, our domain, I guess, you know, the all-information, timeless, spaceless domain that theoretical physicists talk about. Well, how did I get that? Just from, description of these experiences. Well, first of all, deja vu experiences are exactly that. That's when time has no more meaning for you. There's a number of different types of deja vu experiences, but they all have to do with entering into a timeless space. So some people in their deja vu experience will remember past lives, but interestingly enough, other people who have deja vu experiences, they'll have the perception that they've opened a door before. You know, they're walking down the hallway and they're about to open the door, and then suddenly they'll have the perception that they've actually done this before. You know, so time for them has slipped, but, you know, only to the degree of 5 to 10 seconds. And then she also tells us that that by the tumor stimulating this area of the brain, which it does as it grows, then they also had, you know, that intense spiritual experience, that of course, is, you know, part of the near-death experience. So, you know, it's just, I think, more information that it's that this area of the brain mediates the experience as opposed to creating a hallucinatory experience.
Well, that's well put, mediating versus creating, and I guess that sums it up. Donna, thank you for your call.
Yes, okay. And Donna, I wish that you would write to me at my website. I'm right down in Delaware. I'll come up and interview you.
where is
you know,
that?
Because I think that's a very, very interesting. I would love to hear more about that experience, and document it.
The website, Donna,
is your website?
It's spiritualscientific.com. Spiritualscientific.com. Okay.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. So, and I think the email there is spiritualscientific. You know, all one big long word at yahoo.com. But I think that these types of experiences are very important. I'll give you another example.
Well, we're going to have.
I have one patient.
Dr. Morse, unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I'd like to tell our listeners again, if you want to find out more about Dr. Morse and his work, first of all, I'd recommend all of his books, but specifically Where God Lives, The Science of the Paranormal, and How Our Brains Are Linked to the Universe. You could find that. There's a link on our website to purchase the book.
The website spiritualscientific.com is a wealth of information. Dr. Morse is not afraid to take on the skeptics head on, and you'll find some very interesting articles on there and some of his new projects, including remote viewing and Reiki. Dr. Morse, thanks so much for being with us. We could talk for hours, and I hope you'll join us again.
This is one of the quickest hours I've ever had. You have a very excellent show.
Well, thanks, and
I really congratulate you.
And we'll talk soon, and thanks again.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
All right, take care. Good night.
Okay, and now it's time to say our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it. Good night, everyone.